27. April 1, 1933, had been the first climax of the Nazi revolution. In the following weeks, events showed a tendency to revert to being merely matters for the press. Certainly the terror continued, as did the celebrations and parades, but no longer in the tempo furioso of March. Concentration camps had become an institution. One was advised to get used to that fact and mind one's tongue. The Gleichschaltung, placing Nazis in controlling positions of all ministries, local agencies, boards of large companies, committees of associations, continued, but it now took a pedantic, orderly form with laws and regulations. It no longer had the wild, unpredictable character of the individual actions of the previous months. The revolution became official. It became a fact, something that a German is used to accommodating and putting up with. It was again permissible to visit Jewish shops. One was still told not to do so, and permanent posters described one as a traitor to the race if one did. But it was permitted. There were no SA guards at the doors. Jewish civil servants, doctors, lawyers, and journalists were still dismissed, but now it happened legally, and in an orderly fashion, by paragraph such and such of the civil code, and there were exceptions for veterans and people who had been employed before the war. Could one ask for more? The courts, which had been suspended for a week, were allowed to resume their sessions and pass their verdicts. However, judges could now be removed, quite legally, and according to law. The judges, who could be ousted at a moment's notice, were told that their powers had been immeasurably increased. They had become people's judges, sovereign judges. They need no longer anxiously follow the letter of the law. Indeed, it was better if they did not. Understood? It was strange to sit in the Kammergericht again. The same courtroom, the same seats, acting as if nothing had happened. The same ushers stood at the doors and ensured, as ever, that the dignity of the court was not disturbed. Even the judges were, for the most part, the same people. Of course, the Jewish judge was no longer there. He had not even been dismissed. He was an old gentleman and had served under the Kaiser, so he had been moved to an administrative position in some Amtsgericht, lower court. His position on the Senate was taken by an open-faced, blonde, young Amtsgerichtsrat, with glowing cheeks, who did not seem to belong among the grave Kammergerichtsrats. A Kammergerichtsrat is a general, an Amtsgerichtsrat a lieutenant colonel. It was whispered that in private the newcomer was something high up in the SS. He saluted with outstretched arm and a resounding Heil Hitler. The president of the Senate and the other old gentlemen thereupon made a vague gesture with their right arms and murmured something inaudible. Previously they had chatted quietly and knowledgeably during the breakfast break in the deliberating room, discussing the events of the day, or professional gossip, the way old gentlemen do. That no longer happened. There was a deep, embarrassed silence while they ate their sandwiches. The deliberations themselves were also often strange. The new member of the Senate produced unheard-of points of law in a fresh, confident voice. We referendars, who had just passed our exams, exchanged looks while he expounded. At last the President of the Senate remarked with perfect politeness, "Colleague, could it be that you have overlooked paragraph 816 of the Civil Code?" At which the new High Court judge looked embarrassed, like a candidate who has just slipped up in a viva, leafed through his copy of the code, and then admitted lightly, "Oh, yes, well then it's just the other way around." Those were the triumphs of the older law. There were, however, other cases, cases in which the newcomer did not back down but gave eloquent speeches, in a somewhat over-loud voice, stating that here the paragraphs of the law must yield precedence. He would then instruct his co-judges that the meaning was more important than the letter of the law. He would quote Hitler. Then, with a gesture of a romantic stage hero, he would insist on some untenable decision. It was piteous to observe the faces of the old Kammergerichtsrats as this went on. They looked at their notes with an expression of indescribable dejection, while their fingers nervously twisted a paperclip or a piece of blotting paper. They were used to failing candidates for the assessor examination, for spouting the kind of nonsense that was now being presented as the pinnacle of wisdom. But now this nonsense was backed by the full power of the state, by the threat of dismissal for lack of national reliability, loss of livelihood, the concentration camp. They coughed. They said, "Of course, we agree with your opinion, but you will understand." They begged for a little understanding of the civil code and tried to save what could be saved. That was the Kammergericht in Berlin in April 1933. It was the same Kammergericht whose judges had stood up to Frederick the Great 150 years earlier, and faced with a cabinet decree, had preferred jail to changing a judgment they considered correct in the king's favour. In Prussia, every schoolchild knows the story of the Miller of Potsdam, which, whether it is true or not, gives an indication of the court's reputation. The king wanted a windmill removed, because it disturbed the view from his new palace of Sanssouci. He offered to buy the mill. The miller refused. He wanted to keep his mill. The king threatened to dispossess the miller, whereupon the miller said, "Just so, your majesty, but there's still the Kammergericht in Berlin." To this day the mill can be seen next to the palace. In 1933 the Kammergericht towed the line. No Frederick the Great was needed. Not even Hitler himself had to intervene. All that was required was a few Amtsgerichtsrats with a deficient knowledge of the law. I would not remain a witness of the decline of this great, proud old institution for long. My training period was nearing its end. I experienced only a few short months of the Kammergericht of the Third Reich. They were sad months, months of taking leave in more than one sense. I felt as though I were at a deathbed. I was out of place in this building. The spirit that had reigned there was disappearing, bit by bit, and leaving hardly a trace. I had a chill feeling of homelessness. I had not been a lawyer, heart and soul. Indeed, I had not been particularly enthusiastic about the legal civil service career my father had planned for me. Nevertheless, I had had a sense of belonging in this place. It depressed me to see the dismal, inglorious collapse and destruction of a world in which I had lived, not without some feeling of being at home, of participation, even of pride. It dissolved before my eyes, disintegrated and decayed, and I could do nothing about it. My only option was to shrug my shoulders and to admit the certainty that I had no future here. Outwardly, though, everything appeared quite different. We referendars rose daily in importance. The Association of National Socialist Lawyers wrote us all, me included, the most flattering letters. We were the generation who would build the new German justice. Join us! Help us in the historic task assigned to us by the Führer's will! I dropped the letters in the waste paper basket. But not everybody did that. One could sense that the referendars felt their increasing importance. They, not the Kammergerichtsrats, were the ones who now knowledgeably discussed court gossip in the breaks. You could hear the invisible field marshal's batons rattling in their bags. Even those who had hitherto not been Nazis felt their chance. "Yes, there's a sharp wind blowing, colleague," they would say. And with quiet satisfaction, they would report that someone who had only just passed his assessor examination was already employed at the Ministry of Justice, or, on the other hand, of feared sharp presidents of court senates who had simply been dismissed or sent to some obscure Amtsgericht in the provinces. "He was too close to the Reichsbanner, you know. Now he has to put up with the consequences." The atmosphere reminded one of the glorious year 1923, when it had suddenly been young people who set the tone, and one could become the director of a bank and possessor of a motor car from one day to the next, while age and cautious reliance on experience had only led to the mortuary. Yet it was not quite like 1923. The price of admission was somewhat higher. You had to choose your words with care and conceal your thoughts to avoid going to the concentration camp instead of the Ministry of Justice. Confident and proud though the conversations in the court corridors were, they were hampered by an undertow of fear and mistrust. The opinions that were expressed sounded a bit like exam responses learned by rote. Quite often the speaker broke off suddenly and looked around to see if someone had perhaps misinterpreted his words. Jubilant youths, but with butterflies in their stomachs. One day, I do not remember what heresy I had just uttered, one of my co-referendars took me aside, looked closely into my eyes, and said, "A word of warning, colleague. I have your best interests at heart. Another close look. You're a Republican, aren't you? He put a placatory hand on my arm. Shh, don't worry. I'm one too at heart. But you must be more careful. Don't underestimate the fascists. He used the word fascists. Skeptical comments are no use nowadays. You're only digging your own grave. Don't fancy that there's anything to be done against the fascists now. Certainly not by open opposition, believe me. I think I know the fascists better than you. We Republicans must howl with the wolves. That was the voice of the Republicans.